covers wildlife, biodiversity, and climate for the Washington Post. This meet includes writing a column called Animalia, which explores the strange and fascinating world of animals, from why starfish are melting into goo to how bees pass on their names. So I'm going to turn this over to you, Gina.
Thank you for that introduction. So I'm one of the reporters of Washington Post.
I really can't
get a flash of it. I'll introduce my analysts really quickly, and then we can get into it. Right on my right is Brett Cardle. He is Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, which is one of our members really at the center of providing the government to do more about addressing species loss. Christina Morrodi, who is a director and co-founder of Indigenous Lab, a new, relatively new environmental group that is focused on bringing indigenous models from different species to broader audience and to policymakers. And finally, we have Wendy Callan, who is a professor at Simon Fraser University, focused on aquatic ecosystems. So, the last panel was about global biodiversity, so this one's going to be focused on national U.S. biodiversity, really with an eye towards the Endangered Species Act. And the reason for that is because we are celebrating, so to speak, the 50th anniversary of that law, passed in 1973. It was a watershed piece of legislation that really had a turning point in how the U.S. addresses disappearing species. It's been emulated around the world by other countries seeking to protect their own endangered species. And it's in the United States been credited with saving several iconic animals, including bald eagle, brown pelican, the great wolf, the American alligator. In fact, the vast majority of species listed as endangered or threatened under the law have not gone extinct. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them. But there's a flip side to that success, which is that the vast majority of species protected under the Endangered Species Act have not been taken off that list, meaning that they haven't recovered yet to the numbers where they no longer need that sort of protection. So I guess I just wanted to start there, and maybe I'll start with Brad. Like, what do you make of that limbo where species are once not going extinct, but still not cluttered?
So, you know, and that's actually the most common, I was approached from a political vein, it's the most common critique that you'll hear from Republican members of Congress is that the ESA doesn't work because only 3% have been recovered, 97% have not. That's, in their mind, a terrible failure. But there are sort of two main reasons I think that most species are still on the list. The first is biology. If you're a right whale, you can only produce one calf every 2 to 3 years, and if there's only a few hundred of them left, with a overall recovery goal of several thousand, you can only reproduce as fast as your biology allows, right? So another example that's closer to here, back in the Clinton years, there was a proposal to reintroduce grizzly bears to the Frank Church Wilderness and the Selway Bitterroot, the biggest wilderness areas in the lower 48. That was scuttled by the Bush administration. But when they did the analysis, they said that that would be a 100-year-long recovery effort to bring grizzlies back into the big chunk of Idaho, again, just because of biological reproduction rates. Now, some species don't have that constraint, and the other main constraint is funding. Fish and Wildlife Service will usually project how much it will cost to recover species, and the reality is that very few get what they need. So an example close to here, Oregon spotted frog. It was in a congressional hearing just a few weeks ago with Representative Betts, who's the Eastern Oregon representative, who basically is like, well, you know, it's gonna cost $2 billion to recover this. That's not worth it. He basically said, like, it just doesn't seem worth it when we've got 30 million species on the planet. Why should we spend $2 billion to save one? But if you look at the recovery plan for that species, the biggest cost is invasive species control, which is difficult. And if you need to get rid of bullfrog in every creek in Oregon and Washington that have them, it's the per acre cost is huge. So it's going to take a very long time to recover these species because the Oregon spotted frog only gets $10,000-$20,000 a year when its recovery need is $2 billion. So there's both biological constraints and there's resource constraints. And if we funded the law better, you would see a faster rate of recovery because generally when the money is there, species can get recovered on time.
You mentioned Republican opposition to funding for fish laws or to enact this law. It's funny when you go back to the 1970s, you'll see that the Endangered Species Act was passed with broad bipartisan support, signed into law by Richard Nixon. And even if you were to go around Washington today and ask politicians, whether they're Democrat or Republican, they would say that it's not okay to let species go extinct. And yet, the Endangered Species Act just becomes an incredibly politically divisive law. So I guess I just wanted to ask, what do you make of that kind of divide where, there's this recognition that we can't let species go extinct, but yet our main legal tool for doing it is just so divisive?
Okay, everyone. He's doing a kind of pentanico. He's Itzaki. Just want to say greetings to all of you. Greetings to all of you as part of my family and my relations. My Blackfoot name is Wolverine Woman, and I promise I will be kind unless you back me into it. So it's a great question. A very, very wise elder actually said that we are living through a biodiversity crisis and a climate crisis. But the biggest crisis of all is our relationship crisis. And whether that's a relationship crisis between each other, between political divides, or between us humans who somehow think that we are superior to the natural world, we're in a crisis. And I think because it's a crisis, we have to use every tool we possibly can. But we also have to have the humility to recognize that some things don't work in all situations. Some things don't work anymore. The world has changed, and so how do we evolve those tools so that we can actually make a difference, so we can actually turn things around? Another very, very wise person that I met, a rancher from northern New Mexico, said to me, this ESA stuff that you've been working on your whole life, that's kind of cool, but you know what? I make a million different decisions in every given day that have no bearing on the Endangered Species Act effectiveness. So you impose a law on me, you think that's going to work to protect endangered species? How about you engage me in the conversation about what it will take to protect species? Because I love those beans, and that's what I do every single day. So I think really reflecting on how do we connect as humans to solve this crisis that is we're all living through every single day. And it's very easy to get stuck in the grief and the grimness of it, but the truth is, it's real, and it's happening. And many of us have been at it our entire lives, and we're still failing. So if we have humility, will we ask ourselves the question, why are we failing? What can we do differently? How do we do it differently? How can we fix the ESA or augment the ESA? Those are the kinds of questions I would love for all of us to grapple with, because that's the reality of it. The other thing that I will say is, from an indigenous worldview perspective, just thinking about one species makes about zero sense. Actually, calling them a species doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. There are relations. They're part of our cosmology. We have been living with them since time immemorial. Bringing those voices, those perspectives into a conversation about how do we protect biodiversity on the planet needs to happen. It needs to happen a heck of a lot faster. I think globally, kind of wish I had raised my hand on the global panel. Globally, there's so much evidence that part of the reason that we're failing is because we haven't considered these other worldviews. Globally, it's also recognized that 80% of biodiversity is still in indigenous hands and indigenous lands. Why aren't we asking why? So I think there's a lot that can be done with the tools that we have if we open our eyes and look in a much more 360 relational view to figure out what we need to do next together to crack this nut, because it's a pretty hard one.
So one thing that I think about when I try to think about this law is, you know, the environmental problems that were really at the top of mind, 50 years ago were things like habitat destruction, the use of pesticides, killing birds, like DDT, and certainly, pesticide use and habitat destruction are still big issues today, but it feels like we're facing so many more than newly recognized ones. With climate change altering habitats, we have the spread of infectious disease, killing animals where, one pathogen is brought from one continent to another, and the population on that second continent isn't adapted to that disease. So, Brett mentioned frogs, so that's where I kind of want to ask, Wendy, I know you've worked on this with amphibians. I guess, what can we do, or what can the ESA do to, like, stop a pandemic among the animals?
It's a great question. Thanks. And I have a few different perspectives on this, and I'll welcome the other panelists to chime in as well, because I know I really do appreciate the diversity of perspectives at this table, and probably the order, I'm sure. Is that from my perspective as a scientist, I work on species like the Oregon spotted frog. It's a great example. I work on the Among Species Recovery Team. We're faced with really difficult problems, and many of you will know about amphibian disease that has swept around the globe over the last 20 years or so, it's a chytrid fungus, often abbreviated BD is the shorthand that we use, and it was relatively recently determined to have been the most destructive pathogen known to science in terms of the number of species it's actually driven to near extinction or extinction. So it really is a dramatic global pandemic, much larger in terms of the number of species it affects than, for example, the COVID-19 crisis. And it is a challenge because we are an increasingly globalized society. We have literally millions of connections, air, water, between people, individuals coming into closer contact with wildlife populations more frequently, and that's where pandemics come from. And so they are really difficult to control. Some of you will know that in light of that chytrid fungus crisis globally, in the places where, in particular, frogs were declining the fastest in Central America in particular, but also in North America, as the individuals were declining, there was a genetic lifeboating effort. So that's like one thing that we do in the face of pandemics, and it's not a great solution. It's another technocratic kind of human-focused solution where we go and we take the last individuals out of the wild, and we try and capture as much genetic diversity as we can that's currently present, and then we put it in captivity in hopes that we can sustain those species for long enough that when this pandemic sweep moves past, and we don't know what that future looks like, that at least we have the genetic material alive in some way that there could be reintroduction efforts, repopulation efforts. I can say from my work with the Oregon spotted frog, which has suffered from chytrid fungus, but its primary cause for near extinction is habitat destruction. It breeds in wetlands that are the sort of perfect places to convert to agriculture, so 98% of the wetlands that it traditionally has used have been converted, usually diked and drained for traditional agriculture. That's a habitat problem, not a disease problem. And then secondarily, disease comes along and that's another exacerbating stressor. So it is really difficult, and I think what the ESA does is gives us a legal mandate to do what we can. And we don't always know what to do in the face of things like diseases. The other quick story I'll tell you is that there is another chytrid fungus that has emerged in the last few years. It's abbreviated B-SAL. And it's likely to have originated in Asia, but is affecting salamanders in particular in Europe. And North America has the highest biodiversity of salamanders around the globe. And so there was an emergency use of the Lacey Act in, I believe it was 2016, Brett can correct me on the legal details here, in order to ban the import of over 200 salamanders. that are frequently used in live animal trade. And so that's either the pet trade or for food or other, like zoos often move animals around the world with the intention of putting them on display for conservation and for education. You know, that was done proactively, and it's not enough to prevent the spread of this disease. It has not arrived in North America, to my knowledge. There's an incredible surveillance network run by the USGS and other collaborators at universities, where I think something close to 12,000 individual salamanders have been swabbed in North America in the last 3 or 4 years, with no detection of this new chytrid fungus. So there are things we can do. They require Herculean resources. Genetic light loading is incredibly intensive. It's incredibly expensive, with a lot of uncertainties about what's on the other side. So I would say that we still have that legal mandate, which is really important to do what we can. But we don't even, the scientists working on the cutting edge don't necessarily know the answer. And unfortunately, similar to what was just said before, I mean, I think there's a hubris in sort of our technological solutions that we often hope will be the solution that that will help us recover species, whether it's hatcheries for endangered salmon or genetic light loading for frogs. Oftentimes in the rearview mirror, those are things that weren't as positive and sometimes quite negative after we learned more about this. Anyway, there's lots of questions. Yeah.
So anyways, about this because I can't help but shameless plugs, but the Lacey Act bee cell petition was actually petitioned by nonprofits, including my own, helped write that petition because we wanted to see that precautionary approach taken. And just to sort of tie in a few threads, one, I think this one of the strengths of the Endangered Species Act is philosophically it is a precautionary statute. So if you read the famous Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hill case, you know, they describe the Endangered Species Act as the institutionalization of caution. And there is a sort of, I think, a built-in humility that comes with the act, because we know that if we make mistakes when it comes to endangered species, there's really no, you can't do anything about it after they're extinct. So I'll just also flag that, at least on the pandemic front, there was a legislation in the last Congress called the Preventing Future Pandemics Act, which was really interesting. It was bipartisan, both in the House and Senate, with the notion that, you know, that fundamental relationship with animals is something we have to address, and the exploitation, especially for the sort of the wildlife markets for human consumption, have been a huge driver. And you just don't know where the next one's coming from. So the thought was, with that legislation, was to be, again, precautionary and to ban those types of activities around in the United States and to lead an effort in the world to do so, because, yeah, we cannot predict when that next pathogen is going to cause worldwide havoc, whether it's to people or to, you know, ecosystems.
So speaking of worldwide problems, I did want to turn the discussion back to climate change, and maybe after this questions for the audience. You know, the Biden administration has set out this goal of trying to make a carbon neutral electric grid by 2035 that will require a massive build out of clean energy or so-called clean energy, where you know, we know that a lot of this infrastructure will have some impacts on wildlife, but it's not just wind turbines or numbers, which you hear folks like Donald Trump talk a lot about. It's also solar panels encroaching on the habitat of desert tortoises, geothermal power plants encroaching on the habitat of toads and other wetland creatures, hydroelectric dams. The conservation movement has known this a long time, impeding the salmon from another fish from running upstream. So, like, how do we address these twin crises with this, Christina, kind of outlined there? Climate crisis and extinction crisis at the same time. This is good to all the panels here.
It's a really challenging problem. It's another piece. That's actually a topic that I've spent a fair bit of time working on in the last 10 years. Is that our environmental assessment process, both in the U.S. and Canada, where I live, is still really focused on evaluating the potential impacts of individual projects, of one big coal-fired plant or a nuclear power plant or a very large hydropower dam. And it's set up to do that. What it's not set up to do is to think at a systems level about this problem of what if you need 20,000, a combination of 20,000 individual energy generation locations that are wind turbines and small hydropower and solar, community scale solar farms. How do we think about that not as a one at a time problem, but as a collective problem that we can solve? And I guarantee you we come to a different answer if you tackle that as a systems problem rather than a one at a time follow that path. In terms of the impacts to community, human communities, to biological communities, to species. And so I've spent a lot of time for the last decade or so trying to understand how decision makers who have their hands on those levers of power think about these problems. And they think in really sophisticated ways about redundancy and risk when it comes to the power grid. It's a complicated problem, and it is a systems problem. But when it comes to thinking about the impact to species and especially ecological communities, that same level of technological sophistication doesn't really apply to that problem, in part because they're not required to. And so that's what I would say is that our new challenge is to think about this collectively and aggregate. So you'll hear a lot of scientists talk about cumulative environmental impacts. That means a lot of things to a lot of different people, but many of us are studying that from different lenses of recognizing that when we make these decisions in the past, and we try and forecast things like impacts to species or ecosystems or even human communities, and we look backwards, we've always underestimated them. Because we haven't done a good job of really thinking about the benefits from intact ecosystems or the presence of species in communities. And so I think the energy crisis is exacerbating that problem. It doesn't mean that we need to stall and be inactive. I think just the opposite. We have to do this all at the same time. That's one of the things I found myself on the opposite side of the table from local environmental groups who are fighting green energy programs. And it's, you know, they're for good reason. All energy infrastructure has impacts, and we need to have critical conversations about them. But we also don't want those conversations to stall that transition, where it means getting communities off of diesel generators or coal-fired plants.
Thanks, Wendy. I think what Wendy just described in Western scientific terms is the indigenous worldview. And I think it's just really cool to realize that there's just a very natural way in which these different worldviews can and need to come together for these really complex systemic problems that we're facing. Again, I want to bring it back to humility. We kind of have this idea that we can solve these problems in this very linear checkbox kind of way, whether it's social justice issues, species extinction, you name it, every single social, political, economic, ecological crisis that we face, we're looking for those quick fixes and those little boxes to tick. You have a really different perspective when you think out millennia, think out multiple generations, and when your decision making comes from a place of recognizing how everything is connected and interdependent, that everything is sort of in this intimate embrace, you tread a little bit more non-linear. And I think you recognize that, you know, art, whether it's hip-hop or ceremonial song, is part of the solution. You know, science in all forms. I don't actually use the word traditional ecological knowledge, partially it's because I think indigenous science is on par with Western science. I would actually argue it's superior, but you know, I'm biased. And I think somehow DEK is like anecdotal, kind of fishtail, and then there's science, all caps. So I think indigenous science, Western science, they need to be a part of the solution. And I think we need to slow down to speed up. You know, yeah, there's an extinction crisis, but we have to think a little bit more because I would argue in the 30 plus years I've been working globally, locally, nationally on conservation issues from a biocultural perspective, I think things have gotten worse. way, way worse. So if we're going to just keep doing the same old, but faster and faster, man, we're hosed. So I think we got to slow down. I think we got to bring perspectives that we don't understand or know or maybe even respect to the table and try and figure out these solutions together, because otherwise it's just sort of like you squeeze that balloon and the other problem pops out the side. But I truly believe we can fix this. I really do. And I think it requires all of us leaning in with much bigger open hearts and maybe quieting those big old brains that we all monkeys have. So thanks.
It's always hard to follow that up, but I remember before he passed, I heard E.O. Wilson speak, and he argued that, you know, if you save the biological world, you sort of, by definition, have to save the human and then the societies would be built, but the opposite's not true, and I think about that from, like, the perspective of the right whale. We could put a ludicrous amount of offshore wind turbines off the Atlantic coast and create enough power to run the country, and also almost certainly drive the right whale extinct. So, you know, from, I don't know if our organization has an official perspective, but for me, that seems like a great moral wrong to do that. Like, that is not an acceptable compromise or calculus, to just write off a species or an ecosystem in the name of solving the climate crisis. There has to be a way to, you know, move all this forward together. And I think, you know, that's the danger we face in this very current context of, you know, the quote permitting reform, unquote debate, right, which is all about speed. We have to get this all done as fast as possible and cut as many corners as possible in the process. And there are always, you know, costs to that when that happens, and we just don't know who's going to bear it. But that's one of my great concerns, is that if you don't think through these decisions and you just say, well, we got to get 25 gigawatts offshore in 3 years, that can create some really big problems. So it's a challenge, but, you know, I think there are good paths forward to deal with them.
Not that I won't have some other questions, but I did want to ask the audience here if they have anything they want to ask the panelists.
Hello, my name is Fernando. I'm a student at the University of Florida. I'm also a reporter for WUFT. Over the weekend, I visited an urban farmer. I gotta take this off. Sorry. I visited an urban farmer in South Florida who, over the past 9 years, has grown a food forest in their backyard. And they have a tree that is non-native, but they don't see it as invasive because it's filled a specific niche and it's bringing hummingbirds and, like, providing shade. So I was just wondering if you had any comment on, like, the fact that people do value invasives or non-natives, and how do you evaluate whether or not to cut it down? Because at the end of the day, it is sequestering carbon. It is providing some sort of service beyond production, or, you know, there's an intrinsic value to it beyond anything that we can, like, quantify.
I'm happy to take it. I remember when I was in grad school, one of the professors was talking about invasive species and non-native species. One of my fellow indigenous colleagues made a quip, which I know you all know where this is going. So, you know, I think it's a really important conversation. You know, invasive species are tremendously destructive, right? We know that. But again, I think it's a question of place, context, right? You know, as far as I'm concerned, if people are planting trees and trying to feed themselves, and that's awesome. You know, that is the kind of mindset that we all need to embrace in order to really turn things around at scale. Now, if you're going to plant, I grew up in California. We have so many invasive species problems in California. You know, planting, I can't remember the name of it, that grass that we planted on sand dunes to stabilize it. I mean, there's so many examples. So I'll just say, I think it's awesome. Ice plants. Yeah, ice plants. They're really beautiful, but they're terrible. So all to say, like, I think, you know, having people engaged in restoration of any kind, engaging with the natural world at any scale, at any level, is awesome. And then it's just a question of the why, what, and the how in that particular context.
I'll just add, I spent several years a long time ago working on, you know, on the island of Kauai, doing the interspecies work with the forest birds. And there's many different types of invasive species, and I think every context really is critical, because some areas it is the biggest threat to unraveling an ecosystem, and Hawaii is a great example of that. But so it's sort of hard to have like any one size fits all answer applied to the ESA. I think in general it recognizes that when it goes through its decision making processes, but it is very much location, context specific.
I feel compelled to chime in on that one too. Just in terms of looking forward, also just because the specific example you gave, another way to look at it is the relative value of those species to, in that context, to the wildlife, because there have been a lot of studies on native versus non-native trees and other plants, for example, and their value to birds. And non-natives may provide some value to birds, but natives provide like exponentially more. And so cutting down an existing tree might not be a good idea, but thinking about what you're putting in the ground and for what purpose moving forward, there's science. You can find this journalist that sort of like get at that question also. And we'll open it up to another question.
Hi,
hello, my name is Taylor Anshans. I'm a digital producer slash reporter in Southern Oregon and Northern California. And I have heard a lot from both sides of the story in our area about, because of river restoration that's been going on, and how it's negatively impacting agricultural farms in the area who are already struggling with issues related to drought and related to severe wildfire damage. And so I was curious on what you would say, when do we prioritize the Endangered Species Act and restoring these native species to the area over protecting the farmers and the agriculture that's already there?
You know, I assume we're talking about the Klamath River. You know, I think it's, not trying to sound blunt about it, but I think I've always given credit to Congress back in the 70s when they passed most of the modern environmental laws that we live with, in that they did recognize at the time, and the courts have always recognized it and upheld it, that there always are some inevitable trade-offs when it comes to protecting the environment versus sort of traditional economic opportunities. And sometimes that conflict can be quite acute. Oftentimes it's easily sort of amenable, but the Klamath is a good illustration of a place, and this is a tribal-led effort to restore a river that, you know, the dams that were built were really poorly designed. The system can't really support the amount of agriculture that was envisioned and promised 100 years ago in a world of, you know, increasing climate change and drought. And the benefits of restoring this incredible ecosystem will create other opportunities in the future, and there's other values, including for the tribes that are there, that have a deep relationship to that land. But I think, you know, there's always, and we see this a lot, that there's a simplification that occurs often in the rhetoric, where it's the spotted owl that costs the jobs, or, you know, the salmon that costs the jobs. And yes, at some level that's true, but, you know, we do live in this very complicated global economy, and there's many, many factors that go into all of these things. And I think generally, you know, we should be willing to help the people that are impacted, but we shouldn't just automatically assume that the preservation of one economic approach in the short term overrides those larger values, right? I mean, there were people in the 80s that their job was, you know, engine oil lubricants were made from sperm whales. So people lost their jobs when we banned whaling in the 80s. Americans lost their jobs when we banned whaling in the 80s. So it has always happened. It is part of the intrinsic, complicated world we live in. And we should try to help those people, but I think oftentimes that debate gets a little bit too sort of like it's owls versus jobs or salmon versus jobs. Like, it's much more nuanced than that.
You know, I got my start working with small fishing communities, both native and non-native, from Northern California into Alaska. And then I worked with fishing communities in other parts of the world as well. And that's always been, actually it doesn't even matter what the issue is, it's always that you're trying to protect species and you don't care about people. You don't care about jobs, you don't care about livelihoods, culture, etc. And I think that's symptomatic of this bizarre kind of binary worldview that we have, where it's like black or white, good or bad. And the reality is life is way more complicated than that. Just think about your day-to-day. So little is black and white. So I think it's really important to come from a place of love and care and empathy. And I think if we actually looked at these, you know, say, take salmon. How many salmon have died because of prioritizing agriculture and ranching? How many lives have been lost? So, you know, you can spin it any way you want. The truth is we're making bad decisions. The truth is the planet now is, you know, 95% of biomass is humans and livestock. So, you know, these binary questions kind of are not really the right questions. You know, quoting Thomas Pynchon, the American writer, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. You as journalists can help us ask the right questions and make sure that we get the right answers that are nonlinear, that are systemic, that are complicated. But again, if that isn't the right question, fish versus ranchers or cows versus buffalo, don't get me started on that one, we might actually solve some of this. So thanks for the question. It's a good one.
I just wanted to say that was a beautiful answer, and I wholly agree with you. And maybe the only thing I would add is that just in terms of river restoration science, we've seen an experiment in Washington State in the Elwha River. If you're not familiar with it, I highly recommend looking into it. It's a pretty amazing story where there were two dams that were over 100 years old. They really had sort of outlived their technical lifespan, similar to on the Klamath, where there's you know, sort of poor designs and several other things at work. Only the difference was 95% of the watershed lies within wilderness and Olympic National Park, the best, literally the best salmon habitat in the lower 48 of the U.S. And yet that process of decommissioning and taking out those two dams took over 25 years to finally manifest. When it did happen, now almost 7 or 8 years ago for the second one, we got to watch and witness the reinvigoration of these watersheds by returning anadromous salmon to them. And it's remarkable. I get goosebumps just thinking about it and visiting it the first time after the dams came out. It felt like a different place. And I'm sure in terms of an indigenous worldview, it felt like a place that should have salmon in those watersheds. So I will say that the power of some of these, they are not binary and they're complicated problems, but we can undo some of them. We can undo some of these things that were, had we the knowledge, even insufficient as it is today, the knowledge we have today, 100 years ago when those dams were built, we wouldn't have built them in those places. We wouldn't have built them in those ways. We wouldn't have even, you know, we wouldn't have discounted the presence of salmon because there are salmon everywhere. And now suddenly there's salmon almost nowhere. So I just want to echo that many of the same sentiments that Christina just said. I think these are complicated issues, and I am always looking to environmental journalists to sort of pull back the layers of the onion, so to speak, away and redirect the conversation away from those sort of simple sound bites into the complexity of these issues. So thanks for the question.
Well, hi folks. This is Jim Ruggers. With Inside Climate News, and first of all, thank you for coming here today and talking with us. We've heard a lot about permitting reform in Congress lately, and I don't know, it seems like there might be some kind of deal that might get reached at some point. And rather than ask about like what's the proper balance between permitting reform and biodiversity preservation and protection, I'm just wondering, is there some policy language that we should be looking for as journalists to see that there is some sort of proper balance, as you would say, in any kind of permitting reform that would accelerate the construction of new power lines and wind farms and solar panels, solar farms, and that sort of thing?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't know if I have a great answer. I think to me, and I think a lot of the environmental and related communities are really concerned because, you know, the dominant narrative is pretty hard to overcome here. Everyone says it, the president is saying it, it's difficult. I think we've been trying to push back and bring it back to concepts of justice, right? And that's environmental justice, social justice. And I think at some level, like biodiversity as well, like these, there are inherent trade-offs and that come into play when you say, let's reduce, environmental reviews and safeguards in order to speed something being done. And that's, you know, it gets to very fundamental questions about the motivations of what's going on here, right? These are generally the entities that are most interested in permitting reform stand to reap billions and billions in profits. Most of our electrical generation is done by private utilities that are monopolies. The fossil fuel industry will also benefit if Joe Manchin gets his way, because a lot of it is still fossil fuel focused. So we've been trying to remind people again that just the trade-off is you are throwing communities under the bus, native communities, frontline communities, people of color, they tend to be the ones that have these projects built in their backyards over their opposition, and oftentimes rightfully so. I mean, you know, you don't see a lot of oil refineries in Nancy Pelosi's district or Chuck Schumer's backyard. They go where poor people live. So we've been trying to reframe it, but it's a good question. It's hard because it's so easy to accept the notion that permitting reform is needed when in fact, again, there's so much more complexity and nuance as to why any one project is or is not delayed. I'll just give one example. There was a solar farm that was on the National Permitting Council for a decade. The company went bankrupt twice. It has nothing to do with the permits. They just were poorly managed. You know, it was just a bad run company. They changed the design. But NEPA gets blamed, and they say, oh, if we had permitting reform, that would have stopped that. You know, there are boondoggle projects. A lot of dams are like that. I mean, just poorly thought through things, that's going to be the result. So that's how we've been trying, but it is a very dominant narrative, and it has been hard to overcome.
I am Greg Stanley with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And Wendy, you mentioned habitat loss through agricultural conversion. And, that's so much of what we've been seeing in Minnesota. And Christina, you mentioned that you still have hope that we're going to be able to solve a lot of this. And I'm just wondering, have you guys seen any specific solutions or anything specifically that is giving you hope that we can kind of stem this loss of habitat to specifically the way we farm?
Questions embedded in that question. I don't even know where to begin. Maybe I'll just focus on hope. Indigenous-led, one of our biggest projects is
with the Blackfoot Confederacy, which is four nations, three on the other side of the Medicine Line, so on the other side of the United States border, and one on our side here, Blackfeet Nation, Namskapakukani. And we've been working there for over a decade. And I had the privilege of visiting this landscape that I've never been to. I'm actually from there, but I've never been there. And standing on untilled prairie for the first time. And it will drop you to your knees. It's so magnificent. It's so alive. It feels like it sings, right? And I think, again, most people just think, oh, you know, prairie, grasslands, flat, whatever, have a higher value by converting it for ranching and farming. And all you have to do is stand on that prairie to know how BS that argument is. And what's cool and what makes me hopeful is that that's still there. And there's a whole bunch of people that are my age and older who are fighting to keep it there, to get cultural keystones like beaver and buffalo back into that landscape so they can be even healthier. Some of the grasslands that surround it that have been converted can be restored through rematriation of those species. It is so inspiring to see not only the elders and knowledge keepers, but we got young people who are fired up and who want to be a part of this. You know, whether they participate in societies or whether they, you know, make art and graffiti or they make movies, they want to be a part of it. And I think there's something about seeing something that's still intact, that still sings, and then seeing what doesn't anymore and being fired up to make everything sing. I think it's really hopeful. And I think there's a piece of this where we just gotta get people on the land with their hands in the dirt, so to speak, so they see what's possible. And that's not to say there isn't, you know, as we know, Native Gardens, for example, had 300 to 500 more species than untouched landscapes. So it's not to say that we can't farm and ranch. We've been doing that since time immemorial. It's just asking the right questions. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit. Or maybe one of your tiny questions I answered.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that one too. So, where I find hope is in some of the places that still remain intact, and similar to telling a grassland story, I'll tell a wetland story, which is in one of the places that I work in the southwestern part of British Columbia, which is all unceded traditional territory of the First Nations in Canada. There's no treaties were ever signed. There are some really beautiful, intact, what we call floodplain wetlands on the Fraser River, which is an enormous river, almost the size of the Columbia, if you're familiar with it, but there are no dams on it. There are lots of other problems, and the main one from the perspective of somebody who studied wetlands is that 98% or something, don't quote me on that, but it's close to it, of the low elevation watershed has been diked and drained for agriculture, as I mentioned earlier. And it's not like big bad agriculture, like giant, multinational agribusiness kind of corporations in where I live. It's actually blueberry farms and relatively small scale, but still industrial agriculture. They're not going to waste a hectare or less of their land on species unless there's a real compelling argument to do so. But some of the local First Nations and conservation groups have really come to the defense of what looks to be a kind of an agricultural, it's a beautiful area, but is looks to be completely converted when you stand on the landscape and you look out there. But have come to the defense of the few floodplain wetlands that still exist, and really championing those and saying, we can't just because 98% of this landscape has been converted, we're not going to let these last 2% go. And I think there's a real lesson in that, and also in the hope that, restoration, the potential for restoration in North America is so incredibly undervalued. And we know how to do some of this restoration. the example I gave you earlier on the Elwha River, taking out a dam is actually remarkably simple technologically. But we know how to do more complicated things in terms of restoration of grassland, restoration of wetlands. And I think that isn't a part of the conversation enough. But there are people out there fighting that fight every day and trying to sing the song of the remaining intact places where in otherwise heavily converted landscapes for agriculture.
I did want to interrupt with a question there, because you mentioned your work in British Columbia. You had the privilege of being able to work both in Canada and the United States. So maybe you could just briefly compare and contrast these two systems, how we prepare our Endangered Species Act to Canada's law, and what lessons we can draw from that. Maybe what lessons they can draw.
It sounds like Christina also, I know Brett and all three of us can speak to this issue, but I'll just highlight a couple of things. So Canada's Endangered Species Law, which is called the Species at Risk Act, is much younger. It's actually about to turn 30 while ours turns. It only applies on federal land, which in Canada is less than 5% of the land mass in the entire country. Because as you're familiar in the United States with really strong states' rights, if you could sort of convert that to provincial rights, just do the transformation in your head, and imagine it's 100 times stronger. That's what it is in Canada. So the provinces actually own or have purview over, and actually, I'll put an asterisk on that, own with an asterisk, that most of the provincial land that is publicly held. And so the Species at Risk Act doesn't apply on those provincial lands unless the province has a parallel piece of legislation, which many of the provinces in Canada do not. So British Columbia, for example, before I moved there, I had this idealistic view of British Columbia, in part because I'm a biologist and I pay attention to wildlife, and British Columbia and Alaska have the last intact assemblage of all the big mammals. And there are still problems, there's threats, so I thought, okay, they must be doing something right there. And the answer is yes, they are doing something right, but it's not because of things like a Species at Risk Act or endangered species. So there are huge gaps in Canada. We don't have nearly the legal, there is no legal mandate to requiring provinces and even local municipalities or governments to actually save species. It's a very weak law, and it's one that is constantly under attack for many of the same reasons politically. As soon as you say it's a weak law, then people on with some interest in getting rid of it say, well, why do we even have it? So in many ways, Canada emulates the U.S. and almost in lockstep will adopt legislation that looks almost identical. Literally, it takes the language from the U.S. But the Endangered Species Act was not one of those. And so it is, I hate to use the term, but it is more of a Wild West mentality in Canada in terms of endangered species. And I work on a lot of endangered species in Canada. And it's a very complicated conversation because there really is no legal mandate to hold organizations or people to account. There's lots more to say about that, but I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I'm actually, my mom's side of the family is from Canada, and I had the privilege of living and working in Canada for quite some years. And we're spot on that front. I think the other piece of processes, as we could say, that have been really powerful in redefining and reframing, reconceptualizing, I would argue, conservation in what is now known as Canada, is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Wow, that was a good time. And the truth, and you would imagine, maybe, those of you that aren't familiar with truth and reconciliation processes, you would imagine that what the heck does that have to do with conservation? But it has completely and utterly reconceptualized conservation and what it is and how it's done and who leads it in Canada. And so many will tell you that there is no way to do conservation in Canada unless it is Indigenous-led. We don't have protected areas in Canada. We have Indigenous protected and conserved areas. And oh, by the way, because those territories are enormous, we're not talking about tiny little protected areas that really don't do much from an ecological restoration, ecological function standpoint. You're talking about protecting landscapes, entire landscapes, millions and millions of hectares, into perpetuity, and investment in guardian programs, so not only do people from those communities have jobs, but they have jobs that they love and want on the land, and the young people are leading that. I was actually working, I wear many hats. One of the other hats I wear is I work with philanthropy, and I was working for the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation back in the early 2000s, and somebody came to me and said, hey, I'd like a little bit of money, you know, just to get this guardian concept off the ground in Canada. And I was like, sure, sounds cool. You know, and as you know, there's now hundreds of millions of dollars that have been invested. I can't remember the size of that grant. Maybe it was $50,000. There's now hundreds of millions that have been invested in guardian programs and the creation of indigenous protected and conserved areas. So having worked in places like Aotearoa in Canada, it's just really clear the international, we need to be looking internationally to really figure out new ways of resolving some of these issues. Maybe not Canada's version of the Endangered Species Act, we can leave that one alone, but there's other stuff happening that's way bigger than that. And I think that's it's a beacon. You know, back to your question of hope, that was huge hope. That's happened in half of my career, that change. So it's really huge. So let's look north. And south.
We probably have time for one or two questions. Yeah, so.
Hi, I'm a wildlife photographer, and I've been doing work in Texas for the last couple years. And I guess my question, it's a huge question, and we could probably sit here all day and talk about it, but how do you do conservation in a state that's 90% privately owned that hates its predatory species? And how do we save them before we talk about them being extinct or being on the Endangered Species Act, which is also a hated piece of legislation, because the amount of mistrust by those people who own those private lands, and there's a lot to save, and the narratives are false, you know, of why we're persecuting things. We have to manage coyotes and bobcats, and you know, no one cares if they go extinct right now. So how do you have that conversation?
Texas has, I think, the fourth highest number of endangered species in the country. And it's a challenge. It's a challenging state to work in. You know, speaking of state-federal relations, most of the state game and fish agencies, and I put the emphasis on game, you know, we do have some historical anachronisms that we're still left with hundreds of years after the country was founded, that most wildlife is considered to be in the U.S. owned by the state. That's the sort of legal answer. And almost every state's agency that manages has approached it from, like you said, the perspective of predators, right? Which is a horrible term, because it immediately implies that there's a conflict with ranching or other interests, and therefore they must be destroyed. So, you know, there are some pieces of legislation like the Recovery of America's Wildlife Act, which is a practical answer, which is, I think, it's an interesting law. It's gotten a proposed bill, and it's gotten much better over the last 6 years. But one thing it would do is allocate a large amount of money to the, you know, quote-unquote non-game side of the ledger. And I think it actually has the most promise of just reforming the mindset of the state agencies and the cultural biases that are inherent in them. So at least they don't think of every species that is not huntable as an enemy that has to be sort of eradicated or reduced. So there would be more of a sort of a holistic focus. I agree that sort of in Texas, you also have to overcome each private owner's own biases, and that's a larger cultural conversation. But I think a first step is just getting a lot of these state agencies to a better place. I mean, a lot of them really are managing from techniques learned in the 40s. You know, they're really not looking at a lot of this very scientifically or just even in a way other than just, you know, predators bad, you know, big game good, nothing else matters. And that's been really difficult to overcome. We're starting to see some states do a better job, but it's still pretty deeply entrenched.
Sorry about that. Going off of what Brett said, he mentioned this legislative proposal, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which not only will funnel money to states if it's passed, but will funnel money to tribes for the conservation effort. So I did want to ask Christine and others to come into, what is it that tribes need more money to do?
Just a shameless plug for the first version of that bill did not, and some of us environmental groups actually objected along those lines, that all the money was going to the wrong things, and we forced the sponsors to change that. So
the power of allyship. Yeah, it's pretty incredible, actually. There's $97.5 million, I believe, in the last iteration that would go to tribal entities. I don't know if people know, but depending on how you do the math, there's about 140 million acres. I would argue that it's a lot more. But anyway, there's 140 million acres that are in indigenous hands in what is now known as the United States of America. It's a lot of land. It's the fifth largest state. And just like state wildlife agencies and federal, there's so little resourcing that goes to tribes. Another thing people don't know is that there is no secured funding for tribes to do conservation on their lands, even though many of those species that are endangered are on tribal lands. And tribes have been, I would argue, at the forefront of rematriating, restoring, rewilding species, whether that's black-footed ferrets, wolves, you name it. We've been doing it. We're also leading edge in terms of connectivity and corridors. Tribe that I know well that is actually, I sat and asked if I could help them, and they were like, told me what they were doing. I said, yeah, right, okay, you guys got it. Salish and Kootenai have done incredible work around their animals bridge, and they've got all kinds of amazing underpasses. The first thing they showed me was the wolverine, of course, crossing the animals bridge, which is really cool. So basically what, in a nutshell, this legislation would do if passed is put more money in hands that are really, really good at conserving and stewarding wildlife and wild landscapes, our homelands, and maybe even more importantly, to do it in the way that we would from a system standpoint, not an individual species standpoint, right? It really creates space to think from an ecosystem perspective. Plus, how cool would it be to actually honor the people who've been doing this forever and build capacity amongst our tribes, amongst our youth, so they can continue to do it, so they can stay home and work on the land. So.
I think that is about it. That might be a good place to end it. So I want to just thank my panelists for chatting with us, and thank the audience for the great questions. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.